It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. In what's being called one of the world's greatest diplomatic successes, representatives from 195 countries signed a landmark climate accord over the weekend. The agreement solidifies a promise from those countries involved, all of those who have signed on, to drastically reduce their carbon emission limits, effectively helping slow down the damaging effects of global climate change. So how will this agreement end up impacting Pennsylvania? I'm joined now in studio by Penn Future President and CEO Larry Schweiger. Larry, good to have you back with us.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. What do you think of the Paris Climate Accord? What do you think that it can do to prevent global warming? Can it be effective, or was this whole exercise a waste of time, as some believe it was? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Larry Schweiger, first, let's walk through this climate deal. What's in it?
Well, I think there are a number of things that are in it, but most importantly, it's the first time that 195 nations came together and said, we want to act together. It's a huge outcome. And there are a number of reasons why they were able to get there. You know, clearly the science is overwhelming. The amount of damage that's occurring around the world has increased dramatically. Superstorms, huge hurricanes and droughts. And we also have an evolving technology. The technology to solve the problem is coming to grid parity. Wind, solar are both coming down dramatically in price. So there's more appetite for doing the right thing. And I would also say that Americans should be very proud of some of our leaders, John Kerry, President Barack Obama, and of course, Al Gore has worked his heart out for many years helping people from around the world. Al has trained over 8,000 people from every country on the planet to understand and to be able to communicate on climate change. So there's been a lot of momentum over this 21-year period to get us to the point where we are today. And so I think it's a big moment and an important moment for us to respond to.
And how is this deal different from other deals? I mean, we've seen, you know, there was the Kyoto Protocol, which, of course, the United States famously never signed on to. I'm trying to think of other deals in the interim. I guess there haven't been that many where there's been this kind of a consensus. Would that be what makes it different, what makes it more significant?
Well, first of all, Kyoto was flawed from the beginning. It had exempted all the developing nations from doing anything. And, of course, China exploded with their coal usage, and we saw a 56% increase in carbon dioxide since Kyoto. So there's no doubt that Kyoto was a failure. Now, Copenhagen was where the ground rules were set for Paris. The Copenhagen Accord really said instead of having mandatory requirements, we're going to have voluntary. We're going to allow each country to determine how much they're going to reduce the carbon emissions. But clearly, this agreement is different because it did several things. One, it actually acknowledges that 2 degrees Celsius, which was established at Copenhagen, is not enough. We now, you know, recognize that we need to get to 1.5, below 1.5 Celsius.
And again, that's
pre-industrial.
And that's in terms of the average rise of the temperature per year, correct?
That's total rise in temperature for the entire planet. So I should be clear about that. What we're saying is we need to prevent a 1.5 degree rise in temperature from pre-industrial levels worldwide. And so that's the target. It's a very important target. It's scientifically based. It was really supported by the particularly island nations and those nations that have large numbers of people in their low-lying mega delta areas.
And the agreement, the timing of this, what is there more of a sense of urgency now for a variety of reasons? I mean, because we've known that the global temperature has been rising for years, but what brought everybody to the table this year? I mean, you know, nations like China and India that maybe in years past couldn't have been bothered were really involved this year.
Well, I think there are several things, but one really important thing is that the world itself, nature, is starting to respond in very negative ways. The rapid melt of ice from Greenland, incredible changes that we're seeing in the Arctic region, the tundra is melting, giving off its own pollution. There are a number of warning signals that are very strong and unmistakable, and the scientists from all over the world have been warning. And I also think the Pope's role has been extraordinarily important. You know, the Pope, you know, finally came forward and said, this is a moral obligation that we have to our children and their children, and that we need to take every step to protect those future generations. And I think that was a catalyst for a number of countries who were on the fence to realize that this is a moral moment, that we have a responsibility for that future generation.
And in China, where it seems as though the government's been indifferent to the pollution there, people were offended, and U.S. athletes were admonished during the Beijing Olympics in 2008 because they were wearing masks over their faces because they didn't want to breathe in that air that people there live with from day to day. Now you're seeing people walking the streets of Beijing, and they have the masks on. Is there a backlash that has maybe, if not forced, shamed politicians in the leaders in China, shame them into going to the negotiating table or the discussion table in Paris?
I think so. And I also would give credit to the president and to Secretary Kerry for approaching the Chinese in advance of the conference and saying, let's sit down and work out some arrangement.
We're the two biggest carbon polluters.
We're the two big polluters. Let's figure out what we're going to do together. And the Chinese, to their credit, have now established a cap and trade program. They're ahead of us. They're actually doing what we should have done, and it's really kind of ironic because as a communist country, they are implementing a free market tool to curb carbon pollution. And incidentally, they're building more solar and more wind than any other country on the planet right now. So they are moving, they're shifting, and I think there's public pressure building to change that. I think clearly those people wearing masks are upset and are, you know, troubled by the pollution that they are suffering and recognize the need for change.
2 weeks ago today, we had the Chinese dissident Chen Guangchen join us on the program. And he said, I asked him how bad the pollution is there. And he said, there aren't any rivers that you can, that where the water isn't polluted now. And one concern that he raised is he said the government of China will say they are going to cut carbon emissions and then turn around at some point and do the opposite. So how can we trust China to go step for step with us?
Well, that's the other really important thing that happened at this conference. There was an acknowledgement for the need for transparency, and the Chinese have committed to that. The U.S. government has committed to that. The other nations have committed to a form of transparency, which in my mind creates the moment for people to demand their government to do more. This is not the end of the process. It's the beginning. And as they share their progress and share that evidence of their progress, having scientifically defendable targets and so forth, we can then monitor each other and hold each other accountable. And I think that's where this is going to be a worldwide, unlike any other movement in history, this is worldwide. It's going to require people to stay on task. We can't just say it's over, we got a Paris Accord, and forget about it. We need to take the lead and make the changes and demand our government make the changes.
And I'm going to want to ask you about how these nations are going to be held to this, because there's no legal requirement dictating how or how much countries should cut emissions. So we'll parse through that, but I do want to take calls for our guest, Larry Schweiger, who is the president and CEO of Penn Future. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH@WESA.FM. On Twitter at ESSPGH. Let's go to Jackie. Jackie in Washington County. Hi, Jackie. You're on with Larry Schweiger. And Jackie's gone. Let's go to Nick from the North Hills. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. One of my couple questions is, when do they consider the beginning of the Industrial Revolution? That should be around 1800. And what was the climate then? 2 degrees is an awful lot. will they be able to maintain that? Now, my second question is...
Let's save your second question, Nick. Your first question is a good one, and let's clarify this. You say pre-industrial levels, so in predating the industrial age, when the temperature was what, is what Nick is asking here.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the carbon levels in the atmosphere. The carbon levels pre-industrial were about 278 parts per million.
And what are we talking here? Early 1800s?
Yeah, and that was pre-industrial, whether you want to draw it at 1800 or 1860.
So 200 years ago, the temperature was how much lower than it is now?
Well, it's about 1 degree Celsius lower, just a little shy of 1 degree. So
that doesn't sound like much. So why is that? But it is a big deal. So why is it a big deal?
Well, that's the average temperature increase on the planet. But if you go to the Arctic, I've been to the Arctic several times, and when you go there, you see the Arctic is melting because it's seeing double what we're seeing in the rest of the world. And a small change in temperature makes a huge change on the environment. You know, it's sort of like unplugging your refrigerator. We're seeing the melting of the Arctic region. The Arctic itself is a giant reflector that bounces 80 to 90% of its energy back into space. When that ice melts, it starts to absorb more and more energy. So it amplifies this temperature change that we're seeing on the rest of the planet. And that's the danger. We're seeing an overheating of the North Country. And the Arctic has a lot of carbon stored in the tundra. So those are the reasons why people are very concerned about what appears to be a small change in temperature. It's a big change in Arctic region. It's a big change in other parts of the world.
Yeah, this has certainly been documented for sure. Okay, and Nick, your second question.
What subsidies are being given to developing nations such as India and China? India has, I believe they said, threefold over what Peking or Beijing has as far as air pollution. What subsidies are they getting from the industrial countries to implement the policy?
That's a little more complicated question because they were asking for a lot more than they're actually going to get, and a lot of what they're going to get is private investment, and frankly, that's going to go a long way anyways. I mean, a lot of these private companies that are building solar plants and installing wind turbines and doing all the other things are really looking for the opportunity to go into places like India and to into Africa and other countries to help them make the move. You know, it's sort of like what happened with the landline. You know, we all had landline phones, but if you go to Africa, as I have been, you'll find that the people are using cell phones. They never had landlines. They went right to the cell phones. They skipped over a whole generation of telephone. And I think that's what's going to happen in these developing nations. They're going to go right to solar, right to distributed energy, to wind, and are not going to look back on building coal-fired power plants because they're frankly going to be cheaper. And they are already at grid parity in a lot of these places. But nonetheless, we do have to help them.
You're saying there's an advantage to being underdeveloped.
They will have an advantage because they won't have all this stranded asset that we have. We have an enormous amount of – you look at all the coal-fired power plants and the incredible investments that are being made today in gas and other fossil fuels, that they're going to be stranded because we cannot look for these facilities to be operational down the road because they simply will be outside of our carbon budget.
Nick, thank you for those questions. Let's go to Jackie in Washington County, who is back on the line. Hi, Jackie. You're on with Larry Schweiger.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Last year, I read how researchers found that the EPA was underestimating emissions. I guess the EPA relies on information from fossil fuel industries, but what researchers found is when they go out in the field, the actual emissions were 50% higher. So I'm wondering have there been changes or the proposed changes in how they account for the emissions? And then my second question was
let's take the first one and then we'll get to the second one, Jackie.
Okay.
Well, we have a lot of multiple question callers today.
I think Jackie's referring to EPA's estimate of methane. If you look at what EPA was suggesting was we could go to natural gas as a substitute for coal, and they were estimating that the methane emissions were below 1%. Well, it's turning out that they are not below 1%, they're much higher. And so we've been advocating in Harrisburg for rules that curb methane leakage in all the various ways that it leaks in from industrial as well as pipelines and from the fracking operations themselves. EPA, incidentally, has no real authority under fracking. They were taken out by a 2005 amendment to the energy bill by Dick Cheney. They were basically removed from having real enforcement authority. So EPA has been on the sidelines for the most part on fracking and the other energy developments around fracking.
And before you get to your second question, Jackie, when people hear that the EPA is relying on the fossil fuel industry to provide information, should that raise some red flags?
Absolutely. I think the problem is that EPA has, limited authority, so they can't do what they should do. And also, EPA's budget's been cut almost in half. While we ask EPA to do more, we're cutting their budget year by year.
So there's no way that they can check up on these. It wouldn't be cost effective, or they may not have the resources to fact check the information they're getting.
I think that's right. And I also think the American public needs to demand that our Congress properly fund this agency that's so important today.
Jackie, your second question quickly, please.
Okay. What happens after 1.5 degrees is reached? I mean, carbon dioxide is such a long-lived molecule. The heating is going to go on for thousands of years, conceivably, particularly since positive feedbacks are now observed in the environment.
Well, and not only that, but will we see that in our lifetime when 1.5 is reached?
Yes, we will. In fact, we're well on our way to it now.
Okay.
And in fact, one of the things that really drove the conversation in Paris was the challenge from the island nations who were really alarmed at this two degree temperature. It's real important that they get those kind of reductions so that they can protect their islands.
Thank you for that call, Jackie. Let's get to one more call from Robert in Pittsburgh. Hi, Robert. You're on with Larry Schweiger of Penn Future.
Hi, Larry. I'm just wondering if you could, for the listening audience, just comment on the important difference between cost externalization and cost internalization with regard to companies that do renewable, that is, they produce renewable energy source, versus companies that are sort of stuck producing non-renewable energy. How that all works in the marketplace and why it bears so directly on this whole global problem.
Well, that's a great question, and there are two sets of issues with the what I'd call the incumbent industries, the coal, oil, natural gas. They have enjoyed subsidies for decades. And they also have an external cost because their pollution does damage to people all over the world. And those costs have not been internalized into the real price of gasoline or the real price of fossil fuels. So not only do they cause more damage to other people, they're not calculated, but they also get large, we're talking billions of dollars of subsidies that they get. And it's not just at the federal level. There's also at the state of Pennsylvania level subsidies. In fact, as we speak, the state legislature is cutting money from the solar program and moving it over to the natural gas program. They're actually cutting almost $20 million out of solar and clean energy technologies while they're shifting money over to take care of the gas interests that contribute quite heavily to their campaigns.
Robert, thank you for that call. I was talking earlier about how President Obama has said that this agreement sends a powerful signal to the world that it's fully committed to a low-carbon future. But again, there is no legal requirement dictating how or how much countries should cut emissions. So what is there to hold countries to this? And we're getting short on time, but I think this is an important question.
Well, each country has made a promise, and that promise was brought to the table, and those promises were all added up to give us what they consider to be about a 3-degree cap right now. So that they know from the from the outset that they have not done enough to get us to a safe place. But I think the thing that will ultimately keep them at the table is that they will get public pressure within their own governments, whether they're democracy or whether they're not. There's a public upwelling that they have to address. And I think it's important for all of us to be aware that we have a responsibility, not just to put new light bulbs in and change the energy at home, but also to demand that our lawmakers do the right thing for our children and for their children. I have 5 grandchildren, and I can tell you that my grandchildren are at risk if we don't do everything we can. So I'm here today because I care about their future. And I think every American, every person on this planet ought to do what they can to head this off. And I think that's ultimately what's going to protect our environment.
Larry Schweiger is the president and CEO of Penn Future, talking about the Paris Climate Change Accord that was reached over the weekend. We'll see how it all plays out. Larry, as always, great thanks.
Thank you.
Coming up, could eating a vegetarian diet contribute to climate change? It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.